Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Reading in DeadlineDetroit.com today that the Henry Ford's Beatles exhibit is a must-see, according to Mike McGonigal of the Metro Times of Detroit. It includes a brick-by-brick recreation of the Cavern Club, replete with period instruments, amplifiers, and scratched graffiti. That is Mike McGonigal's favorite part of the show. That is where, of course, the Beatles first performed back in, I guess, 1956. They made nearly 300 appearances at the club. The exhibit is described as the most exhaustive Beatles exhibition ever assembled, and it even includes the band's actual breakup letter, which is really, it's nothing more than a letter sent to Paul McCartney's lawyer, kind of a weird curio here that is part of the Henry Ford's Beatles exhibit, a must-see, according to the Detroit Metro Times. You're reading that today on DeadlineDetroit.com. Back at a couple of weeks ago, current state Scott Pohl visited the exhibit and walked around and conducted an interview, which you can find at WKAR.org, by the way. It aired here on this program. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to Current State. The Zika virus has remained in the headlines in recent weeks, primarily as a concern to pregnant women and their babies. With the Summer Olympics in Brazil on the horizon, recent conversations about Zika have included thoughts on how the disease might travel beyond the tropics in warmer climates. Now, MSU Associate Professor of Entomology, Dr. Michael Kaufman, recently spoke with Greening of the Great Lakes host, Dr. Kirk Heinze, about the Zika threat. They discussed what Zika might mean for Michigan this mosquito season. Dr. Kaufman tells us about a disease that's believed to have originated in Africa
and has spread through parts of French Polynesia into Asia. And most recently, the widest spread is in South America, Central America areas.
One of the most virulent aspects of this is the tendency to cause microcephaly among infants. What actually happens in those cases?
A lot of it remains a little bit unclear, but it appears that the virus somehow bridges from the mother to the developing infant, infects the brain tissue, and I think there's some recent research going on to try to determine which particular cells in the brain are affected and why Zika, this particular virus actually hits those cells. There are a lot of viruses transmitted by mosquitoes, including some in Michigan, that are what we call neuroinvasive, right? So you're probably familiar with West Nile.
You've certainly heard West
Nile, and that's going to be a recurring thing. We don't know what's going to happen these 2 years, but that's also a neuroinvasive virus in the same family as Zika. So it just doesn't, as far as we know, affect infants. And that's kind of the question as to why Zika is, particular in being able to invade the brain cells of developing infants.
Well, this program has a Great Lakes and a Michigan focus, so let's talk about the likelihood of Zika here in Michigan and in the Great Lakes region. There are a lot of questions, particularly among young mothers or pregnant women or those who are about to begin families, but what would you say to them?
Science is always a matter of probabilities, right? And my contention would be that the probability of anyone in Michigan picking up Zika via mosquito is extremely low. We don't have the mosquito species that we know transmitted in the tropics, so we don't have those particular mosquitoes here. And it's unknown exactly, how competent some of our native mosquitoes are. I mean, it's, again, I tell people it's probably in the lightning strike, probability numbers, very, very unlikely. The only time the Zika is going to come into Michigan is via a traveler, and we've had cases already. There have been several people who have been diagnosed with Zika who have traveled to some of the areas. Puerto Rico is one to really be watchful of. But once they get here, then, a particular mosquito, would have to bite that person. And then not only that, live long enough for the virus to kind of increase in the mosquito, and then it would have to find another person to bite. And the reason that, we have mosquitoes that would potentially do that in Michigan, but the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the one you introduced at the beginning of the program, is really, really tied into humans. So it is attracted to humans. It likes to bite humans first. Many of our mosquitoes around here, they'll bite a human, and if, you know, then they need another meal, your dog is going to be, you know, just as likely to, you know, provide blood for it as, or deer, or, you know, some other mammal that, that you'd find. So that's kind of a long answer to your question, but I think the risks...
No, but it's a good answer to the question.
Thanks, but I think the risks for, you know, any, you know, person in Michigan are really, really low. We can't say zero, but... you know, really, really low.
We're talking about the Zika virus with Dr. Michael Kaufman, who's an associate professor of entomology at Michigan State University. Mike, a lot of communities, though, not just in Michigan, but around the United States, are taking what they think are proactive measures, which often includes a lot of spraying of pesticides and what have you. Seems to me, based on what you just said, that number one, that might be a waste of money, and number two, it's not particularly good for the environment.
Depends on where you are in the United States, I'd say. So I think there are certainly southern states that have a higher risk, Florida being a really good example, places in Texas and some of the species of mosquitoes you can find, and even in Arizona and California, but they tend to be southern. Hawaii would be another, you know, United States state, territory, or whatever, that potentially has the mosquito and could transmit Zika locally. There are two, to complicate the stories, there are two species that we think may be involved. The first, the yellow fever mosquito, is what most people think is the primary one. There's the Asian tiger mosquito, another invasive species that has a more northern distribution. And that, you know, if you're in an area with that mosquito, the risk, you know, increases relative to, say, those of us in Michigan, which we don't have either of those species here.
But that latter species you mentioned, it has moved further north, right?
Yeah, it's established.
It's
actually, exactly. So the worry, and in fact, I'm involved in this, and the state of Michigan is involved in looking for Aedes albopictus in areas of Michigan, you know, with the idea that it, if you have these populations and somehow Zika comes into a neighborhood or whatever, there could be, you know, minor local transmission. But that would be the most serious one. The yellow fever mosquito, even though if somebody brought some up here and started a, you know, population, you know, inadvertently or on purpose or whatever in the summer, it could do pretty well, you know, during a few months of our summertime, but it would never last through the winter. So it'd have to be like brought in, you know, every year for that. So back to your question about, you know, spraying and things, I think it actually is not necessarily a bad idea to be proactive in areas where you know you have Aedes aegypti. Aedes aegypti has in fact spread dengue and chikungunya locally in places in Florida. So these are diseases transmitted by the same mosquito. And, you know, again, there was enough of an influx of traveler, you know, related human people with diseases, and then the mosquito's already there, so it was able to transmit in some areas. So if you have that, if you're in an area where you have Aedes aegypti, I'd say the, you know, extra, you know, spraying or whatever is probably warranted. Then it gets a little iffy, in my opinion, as to whether just because you have albopictus, you're going to go blanket, you know, spraying, you know, in an area. It's not, again, it's not impossible. If we had albopictus, I'd say our risk in Michigan was, you know, elevated, but not, but still, you know, relatively low to moderate for that. Most of the people that I know, in mosquito control, either in districts here in Michigan or in private companies, are really very, very good at how they apply the pesticides. And if they're reputable and, you know, professional about it, the environmental impact should be, you know, relatively low. Yeah, so they use, if, for example, I mean, the common thing that people think about with mosquito spraying is, you know, like a truck coming down the street and, you know, spraying stuff all over. And it is a general insecticide, but it's has low toxicity, you know, for mammals and all that. And the formulations that are used under those circumstances, it's very low volume. It's really directed at small flying insects. And if they spray at night, you know, the majority of things are going to be hitting are mosquitoes. And it doesn't last very long. That's one of the key things. Once you, you know, this particular formulation, if you spray it, it's not like it lies around for weeks and weeks. It dissipates and becomes inactive, you know, fairly quickly. So there are concerns. There are concerns. People in my department who are experts on pollinators, you know, for example, you know,
we've done some stories on that for this program, right?
Yeah, yeah. There is some, you know, a lot of beekeepers are don't like mosquito control people, and I think Some of that is unjustified because actually, again, the mosquito control people that I know of go out of their way to avoid, you know, spraying in areas. Again, they usually spray after bees are active and the stuff doesn't last very long. But again, these are general insecticides, so you can never, you know, really say, okay, there's zero effect.
A couple of take-home messages for young mothers who might be or pregnant or what have you listening to this program.
Gotcha.
What are some of the precautions they should be taking?
Right. So the biggest precaution you should be taking if you're traveling to areas with Zika, then you want to make sure that you're, you know, located in a place which has air conditioning, window screens, you know, avoid these mosquitoes. Use a good repellent if you're going to be exposed to it. The other half of this question, which is fairly unusual for similar viruses, is that it can be sexually transmitted.
Right.
So if you know, if you have a partner, husband who's been traveling to areas like that, and even though he may not be showing symptoms, right? Zika's,
right.
You know, you can get Zika and maybe not show symptoms. You should have him checked before you have sex or,
or
take precautions,
yeah.
You know, when you have that, because that's the other way. I would actually say that people in Michigan are more at risk of, you know, getting Zika from a sexually transmitted act, you know, versus a mosquito.
Than Aedes aegypti.
Right. Exactly, yeah, much more.
Right. Well, we've been getting the straight scoop on the Zika virus. And for more information, I know the Center for Disease Control has a lot of information.
Really, excellent.
You've written some papers for MSU Extension. People can just Google, I would imagine, Zika virus, but look for MSU Extension as
exactly.
One source of information.
Exactly.
My guest has been Dr. Michael Kaufman, Associate Professor of Entomology at Michigan State University. Mike, thanks for clearing up some of the myths and getting us straightened out on all things Zika.
My pleasure.
Coming up on Current State, a number of mature trees have been cut down earlier than planned at the site of an impending Lansing development, the Red Cedar Renaissance. The cutting was moved up to prevent endangered bats from nesting in them. We'll talk about the trees and other aspects of the development with a key planning figure, Ingham County Drain Commissioner Pat Lindemann. That's coming up on Current State. Not far from the Marsh Road, traffic whizzing by Meridian Mall is some of our community's most deeply rooted history. For more than a quarter century, the Nokomis Native American Cultural Learning Center has been dedicated to the preservation of Anishinaabe legacy. This includes the Ojibwe, Odawa, and Potawatomi nations, which were the first inhabitants of our area. The center fulfills its mission through exhibitions, storytelling programs, and special events. WKAR's Peter Wharf met with Education Coordinator Vicki Voges last week to see a few of the center's many artifacts and to get to the core of our state's history.
Yes, it's all about Native American in Michigan. Like I had said, the name Michigan comes from Mishigami, which means big water. And that's Anishinaabe Mohan, one of the original dialects, Ojibwe dialects of Michigan. So, you know, and even this town is named after an Okima, a chief, you know, Chief Okemos. Mm-hmm. And everywhere you look, there's reference to Native American. And not to know the Native American history here in Michigan is like not knowing your grandma.
The name of the center comes from the idea of grandma, of grandmother.
Nokomis means grandmother, and grandmother was one of the main teachers, and is still one of the main teachers in Anishinaabe culture. Of course, grandfather had his teaching techniques too, but his was more male orientated, you know, back in the day, you know, for hunting and the things that men did with the tribes. But the females were more the teachers, mm-hmm. teachers of life and lessons. And so I think that's why they decided to name Nokomis. Mm-hmm. So this started in 1989. As a nonprofit, it struggles, you know, financially, as all nonprofits do in museums, especially since the recession. And there is a phrase called the silent voice and the silent people. I think people, when they think of Native Americans here in Michigan, they automatically think of casinos and that all the problems are solved, and that just isn't the case. That just isn't the case. And I just don't see the same... the same reference when it comes to ethnic groups. and the problems that ethnic groups in America or Michigan are facing. You don't hear that much about Native American, do you? And yet they're the indigenous people of this country. 14,000 years back, the first people that were here. Mm-hmm. That's a long time. They should get a little recognition besides casinos, don't you think?
Yeah. What do you think are some of the major problems that people face?
Probably being misunderstood. And also people have contrived in their minds what they think is truth about the natives here. We have panels that we put together called The Elders Speak. And you would be surprised what I've heard people come in here and say about what they think and what they believe. It's far from what the reality is, you know. At one time, I mean, the Native people were the poorest indigenous group here in America and Michigan, too. The reservations were very poor. The casinos have done a wonderful job in helping to bring that standard of living up. But, you know, with casinos comes all the bad attributes of the human being, i.e. greed, you know. So you have to watch that.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Vicki Voges at the Nokomis Learning Center in Meridian Township. Describe where we are right now. Kind of give listeners a picture in their minds about where we are.
Okay. Meridian Township Clock Tower. Meridian Township offices. Mm-hmm. And you can see us from Marsh Road, you know. There's colors all along the banner of the building, you know.
What do the colors in the design tell us as we're driving by and looking at the building?
People are distracted easily, and they just might think, wow, Meridian Township really has a colorful building, mm-hmm. you know. But it tells us, actually, it has to do with the medicine wheel and the colors of the medicine wheel, which is a teaching symbol that has been adopted from the Southwest. What you're looking at right here on the ground is a symbol. That's the medicine wheel symbol. And so there are teachings in each direction.
It's a circle with four quarters, right. A black, red, white, and then sort of a
yellowish.
Yeah.
Yes, right. We need a grant for a new rug.
Right.
Or a donation to get a new rug. It's been there for a while. But and the colors can change, even in the state of Michigan. As you go farther up north, some of the colors change a little bit. But, you know, those colors are around the outside of the building.
Yep.
So that kind of distinguishes it, you know, I'd say. We do teachings, maybe about three or four of the teachings that go with the medicine wheel, mm-hmm. mostly to elementary school children. And then foreigners. We get a lot of foreigners from MSU. There has been people here from Turkey, mm-hmm. and some of their legends completely correspond with our legends.
Really?
Yes.
In what ways?
In the, like, the wolf, Brother Wolf. Yes, the legend of Brother Wolf in Turkey. Very, very similar. Very, very similar in their culture, in their old culture. Wolf was the brother of their people, too. And, you know, there was communication there.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Vicki Voges. We're in a room right now that's probably, 400 or 500 square feet or so. Mm-hmm. And these photographs grabbed me right away, too, because...
Mm-hmm. Those are photographs of photographs. Mm-hmm. So those sure. are very, very old. But everything you see in the gallery here is from Great Lakes, Michigan Great Lakes Native Americans. So this is a not outside of Michigan. So either there is an artist, you're seeing the art that was created, or baskets, or you know, something that is associated with the culture of the Great Lakes Indigenous people.
What are we looking at now?
Well, what we're looking at now is a very old pipe bag, and it seems to be Sioux. Not a whole lot of people know that the Sioux were in the upper UP at one time. They came across the upper UP. And there actually is a Sioux tribe still in Wisconsin. But they met strong resistance from the Chippewa there. And the Chippewa pushed them out. But one thing that did last is some of their designs, which are very, very different than the woodland designs, if you look and see.
Does
it's
the
beautiful.
Bag with these sort of these geometric shapes?
Yes, yeah. The bag with the geometric shapes. Mm-hmm. The other one is an old medicine bag, mm-hmm. and then you've got some old beading, some beadwork, and then a beaded purse. That's it's because of its metal top tells you right off that it's an earlier date. It's not that old. It's old, but it's not as old.
And then next to this. Pipe bag. What's this strip here? It's beautiful with the mm-hmm. kind of leaves and flowers.
Right. That is a sash, and that is woodland style sash. You can tell by the beadwork mm-hmm. because of all the floral designs.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what's next door here.
Well, in this case, you have a medicine fan, a bald eagle medicine fan, and then this is a barrette, all bald eagle feathers. Mm-hmm. That a man would wear. So this is a man's barrette. And then you have his apron, you know, that is really beautifully done with woodland design. And then it also, you'll notice the World War II.
Mm-hmm. Somebody was a veteran here.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he's showing respect for his father on this. And so he would wear that into the circle and at the powwow or maybe in ceremony of some sort, you know, as in honor of his father who...
served in the Pacific.
Right, as a CB.
Yep.
World War II.
I see that.
You know. One of the biggest things that's happening here, let's walk over here because you can't see it,
yeah.
is our project that we hope to have done by the end of the month is the bald eagle's nest.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned this on the phone earlier this week.
Mm-hmm. This is going to be 4.5 feet across and hopefully about 2 feet deep. Now, this nest, I can't tell you where exactly it fell, but it was in Bath. Okay.
This is an actual nest that
was.
It's fantastic.
I know, and it's the only one in the state that I know of. I've been making sure and checking before I make that statement, but so far it's the only one I know of.
This is incredible. It is probably 3 feet across, 1.5 feet or so deep, and it is a work of art. I wasn't prepared to see something like this. This is unbelievable.
Thank you
so
much.
Not prepared for this.
Oh, thank you. Because I am hoping that this will help Nokomis kind of rebirth financially, and people will want to come in and see the nest. I know that when there was a couple of eagles down at Potter Park, they made a big fuss about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have a live eagle in here, but we have the nest. And so I'm real excited about that.
Vicki Voges at the Nokomis Learning Center in Meridian Township. Vicki, thanks again.
All right, thank you. Chi-mi-gwech, that means thank you very much.
Thank you very much. For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And coming up on Current State, he won 2 Tony Awards for writing the musical version of The Bridges of Madison County. We'll speak with composer Jason Robert Brown about that musical, which opens at the Wharton Center later this week. That and more coming up on Current State. Michigan's Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly is urging fellow Michigan Republicans to get behind Donald Trump is the party's presumptive presidential nominee. The lieutenant governor tweeting last night, it is time for Republicans to unify behind Donald Trump. That was a tweet last night. Callie originally endorsed Ohio Governor John Kasich ahead of Michigan's March 8th primary. He was elected a Kasich delegate to the Republican National Convention before the Ohio governor dropped out of the race earlier this month. We're learning this courtesy of Chad Livengood of the Detroit News here in today's edition. This is Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Drive by the old Red Cedar Golf Course near the Lansing, East Lansing city limit, and you'll see several large piles of recently felled trees waiting to be hauled away. The trees were set to be removed to make room for the $276 million Red Cedar Renaissance development, but they came down earlier than originally planned. That was to keep two species of endangered bats from nesting and raising young in those trees. Questions have been raised over whether the city of Lansing, which owns the property, was sufficiently aware of the plan to remove the trees. Our next guest plays a key role in the infrastructure planning at the site. Pat Lindeman is the Ingham County Drain Commissioner and is at work at designing a new drain system for that area. He is here to share his perspective. Thank you for being here today.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Remind our listeners what your role as Drain Commissioner is in that area.
There's a 1906 drain called the Montgomery Drain that's been there well over 100 years now. It is in pretty bad shape overall. It was modified in the 1950s and then again modified in the 1970s. And both those modifications increased the ability of the water to leave the land and get to the river fast, which means that it picks up the pollution along the way. The infrastructure that we're going to rebuild will be made up of a variety of hard infrastructure and soft infrastructure, meaning low-impact design. The goal is to eliminate the pollution going into the river. Currently, right now, we estimate that there is somewhere between 45 and 75,000 pounds of pollution each year, depending on how much it rains during each year, is going directly into the Red Cedar River. The design of the drain that we're going to build is going to try to eradicate that deposition of pollution into the river. Mm-hmm. And then we have to build the drain in and around a development,
right,
which is going to be on the site as well.
So it's pretty exciting, actually. It is an enormous project. You can't drive by there without noticing the changes to the landscape. That is to be sure. But we've got several huge piles of trees, which, according to the Lansing State Journal, got the attention of Lansing City Councilwoman Patricia Spitzley, who is saying, hey, it looks like a tornado blew through there. This is still city land. What's going on? From your perspective, does she have a point? Has the city council been left out of the loop here, as far as you know?
No, they've all been in the loop. In fact, I've met with all of them. We've had conversations with every one of them. Even a year ago, we talked about taking the trees down early at a committee meeting. I don't know where that comes from, but nonetheless, they're all aware of the development. You know, the public voted to engage in this development twice by popular vote on a ballot, and both times it exceeded 70% of the popular vote. The public knows it's coming. Most of the comments that I've gotten are, wow, it's about time. Well, let's get started. Let's go. This is a good thing, not a bad thing. Mm. If you read the headlines in the journal, it makes it sound like something terrible is happening. But actually, this is going to create up to 2,000 new jobs. This is construction jobs alone will exceed 2,000. Permanent jobs, 1,500 to 2,000. It's a massive investment from the private sector. There's all kinds of opportunities here to create economic development, fresh start for all kinds of activity on Michigan Avenue, and clean up the river at the same time.
These trees did come down somewhat earlier than originally planned, though. Isn't that correct?
No, this is exactly when we planned them.
And this is, okay, but there were concerns. The trees, I'm told, came down late March, mm-hmm. and this was to in order to prevent these two species of bats from nesting.
Yeah, there's a federal law that protects the two species of bats, which are known to roost here. And if you leave the tree, they migrate up here around April 1st to after any time after that, they could be here. And we wanted to cut the trees down prior to them arriving. And that way we could ensure that we wouldn't hurt the bats or kill them. We love bats. I mean, this is to protect the bats. So if we cut the trees down early, we couldn't get in to remove the trees because the soils were too wet for the heavy equipment. But the equipment is in there now, and they're starting to dispose of the trees by grinding them up, and they'll recycle the debris from the trees. Will all be made into yard material and that kind of thing.
They're not being hauled away, though. They're being ground up there at the site. Is that it?
That's correct.
And which bats in those trees are we concerned about here?
There's a Indiana brown bat and a northern long-eared bat, which are common to the Midwest and to Michigan. And they've shown a decline in population, and we certainly do not want to add to that decline. So cutting the trees down early and letting them lay there was the best way that we could protect the bats. The trees were going to come down later this year anyway, but we wanted to make sure that when we cut them down, there were no bats in them.
It crossed my mind whether the bats could nest in the downed trees, though, if they're laying there for weeks. Is that possible?
No, they won't. That discourages them. They won't. Once they're on the ground, the bats won't harbor themselves in them.
This led to another question for me here. I'll sometimes see raccoons or skunks slink down a drain when I'm out walking our dog. How much wildlife lives in the drain infrastructure? Do you deal with that on any kind of regular basis?
Yes, we do. All over the county, we have miles and miles and miles of both pipe and open ditch. Some animals, such as raccoons, have been known to crawl up and build homes in some of the larger pipes. Of course, when the rain comes and the pipe flows pretty fast, it's like shoots them right out. We've even had some raccoons crawl up pipes and die there, and then it plugs the pipe up. But yeah. We deal with it. But generally speaking, the way that we like to manage stormwater today isn't like the 1950s. We don't want to just get rid of it and move it to the river. We're trying to build ecosystems. We're trying to mimic nature with our stormwater facilities.
You're trying to filter the water that ends up going into the river, correct?
Yes.
At the risk of oversimplification, that's kind of what you're trying to do.
Well, that's one aspect of it, yes. We want to make sure that we can extract the pollution created by our changes in the landscape. Shopping malls, subdivisions, and all those kinds of things, roads, sidewalks, they all increase the amount of pollution that gets to the river faster. So we want to slow that down.
We're talking with Drain Commissioner of Ingham County, Pat Lindemann, about matters involving the planned Red Cedar Renaissance Project near Michigan Avenue across from Sears on the east side of Lansing. So you're at work designing an upgrade to the Montgomery Drain. How far along are you on that design? What can you tell us about it?
Well, it's somewhere between 45-50% done, maybe a little over 50% done in our design process. As soon as I hit around 65-70% done, we'll have some decisions that will have been made in terms of what we can do. We now have the easements over Rainey Park and Red Cedar Park, so we're ready to use those as a destination for our route and course for the water. And we can now pinpoint and target the kinds of pipes that we'll have to use to take it there. Other facets of the infrastructure need to be fixed. There are some broken pipes that need to be fixed. We can start adding all of that up and come up with a price here pretty soon.
Kind of cost estimate now?
No, though? I couldn't begin to tell you. It would be whatever I said would be wrong in some way, I'm sure. I don't know how many 8-foot, 24-inch pipes I need. Mm-hmm. I can't add up a number until I figure all that out.
You put together an ideal design, and then you get most of the way through it and then kind of crunch the numbers.
Well, we come up with some concepts, and then after we have the concepts and we know that there are certain outcomes that we have an overall goals and objectives, which is to eliminate the pollution is our main goal, and to control the flow of the water. So we have to then interrupt the flow, stop it, slow it down, clean it, move it to the river slower, and we have to find a place to put it. So all of that takes a great deal of thought and investigation. And like I said, we're about 50% through that. When I get to somewhere around 65% or so, we're going to hold a public hearing and show everybody what we have.
When do you think that'll be?
I'm looking toward August. It could be September. Depends on how fast we can go if we don't run into any trouble.
There was tension over who would pay for this work, and I know lawsuits were launched by City of East Lansing, I believe, Lansing Township, in Frandor, but they were either dropped or dismissed. Do we know any more about who's going to pay what for this?
This is a Chapter 20 drain under Public Act 40, which means that the municipalities and the different road departments, the State Highway Department and county, pays for the county roads that are there. Clifford Street at that point is a county road. And then there's Lansing Township, and City of East Lansing. And all of those will divide the cost of the infrastructure improvements up among themselves. And in a Chapter 20 drain, again under Public Act 40, each of these municipalities, excluding the Highway Department and the Road Commission, or the Road Department for the county, have the ability to then tax it back to the properties that are benefited by it. Mm-hmm. Whether they exercise that right to do that or not depends on them.
Before you go, I feel obligated to ask you about another fairly startling development from last month. A couple of hard drives in your offices at the county were seized by law enforcement as part of a child pornography investigation. You told the State Journal that what appears to have happened is that someone outside your building accessed your internet system and what? Apparently visited websites with child porn. Where does that stand right now?
After their investigation, which I'm glad they did that, they found nothing illegal. So, but what it did do, I guess the best way I can say it is we took lemon and made it into lemonade. We had a woefully weak internet system, which the county provided for us, and it's now boosted up. You could sit in the parking lot and get on our internet and into our server. And it's now strengthened. It's got codes and all the different security functions that should have been there before. So we wound up with a brand new security system. That's good. And we did find some inappropriate material on one of the computers in our office, and that's being dealt with internally. So
was it
nothing
child,
illegal, though.
Was it child porn?
No. That would be illegal.
Okay. All right.
There was no child porn found.
Pat Lindeman is the Ingham County Drain Commissioner. We've been talking about the Red Cena Renaissance and other matters. Patrick, thank you for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, The Bridges of Madison County, the best-selling book by Robert James Waller, has been adapted twice for the performing arts. First was the hit movie with Meryl Streep and Clint Eastwood. Second was the Broadway musical version, which garnered composer Jason Robert Brown 2 Tony Awards. The latter arrives this week at East Lansing's Wharton Center. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with this celebrated songwriter about his Tony-winning music for the romance between an Italian war bride and a National Geographic photographer.
Jason Robert Brown, thanks for joining us.
Oh, please, thank you.
Let's start at the very beginning and the twisting kind of cello figure which begins the musical and shows up several times in your writing. Now, for me, I have trouble disassociating solo cello repertoire from Bach and his cello suites. But Bach is German, not from Naples, which is where the character of Francesca in The Bridges of Madison County is from. Which is to say, where does that figure that you wrote, which underscores a lot of Francesca's music, where does it come from? I mean, is it Donizetti or something?
No, it's not. I mean, you're not wrong to hear the Bach in it, but what it signifies something that is essentially European. There are, you know, it's a score with a lot of different musics in it, and I think that Francesca's upbringing probably included that piece of material. Somebody in her town, you know, played that on the cello because that's, you know, what you would. So there's some of that music is in her background someplace. What's most important is that nobody in Iowa was making that music. That's something that only means something to Francesca. And so It has, to me, there is a lilt to it that feels Italian, but I don't disagree with you about the Bach. I get that as well. But I don't feel like it's entirely contradictory.
Yeah, just representative of the European stage, right?
Yeah, something that is more formal. I think of the Midwestern part of the story as being a little bit improvised and sort of earthen. And I think of, the Francesca's life in Europe as being a little more proscribed, a little more circumscribed, more formal, more structured.
There's a boat that leaves from Napoli every Thursday in the morning, and a nervous bride can share a bed with her soldier from the States. For a week.
From one of the more famous stories of musical theater, Sondheim had that kind of assignment that he got from Oscar Hammerstein II, and part of that was to musicalize a story you love as well as musicalize a story that you liked but found flawed. Which one is Bridges for you?
What's hard about Bridges, and what was always hard, is that I find the novel very hard to get through, and it's not particularly long, but I find that the writing is sort of so purple and florid that it's very hard for me it was very hard for me to take it seriously for a long time, honestly. But what that writing uncovers, the story of those two people, and honestly, the characters that are portrayed in there, once you can get past all the verbiage, there is some very truthful and very beautiful things written about Francesca and Robert Kincaid. And so I had to fight my way through the thickets of the writing itself to find what I think is ultimately actually some very truthful stuff in there. But I resisted it. I tell people that when The Bridges of Madison County came out in the 90s, I was a straight kid in Manhattan. It had no interest to me. And it was, it was then what 50 Shades of Grey is now to a certain extent. And so I never took it seriously. And when the book came our way as this is a property and the rights holders want to try and exploit the material and make a musical out of it to maybe get it back in the public eye. And I think Marcia and I both thought, well, come on, get out of here. And then Marcia read it and she said, no, I think this is something we want to do. And I said, I'm going to have to trust you on that. And she said, let me come up with how this thing works. Let me find the story that's hidden in here. And then let me talk to you about it. And I said, okay. And she came out to L.A. where I was living, and she said, all right, here's what I know about these two characters and the people around them. And then there are these characters who aren't even in the book, but I think they're important. And then there's these. And I said, the minute she started talking, I heard the music of the show. And I said, oh, actually, I get it. It's all strings, and it's an octet. And it's, certain decisions suddenly became very clear. Mm. And I take those kind of signs seriously, because a lot of musicals are, just chiseling, endlessly. And The Bridges of Madison County was not that. It was written, I won't say quickly, because none of my shows ever get written quickly, but there was an inexorability to it that was really very beautiful.
You and I are just one second spinning by in one split second. You and I have just one second and a million miles to go.
We're speaking with composer Jason Robert Brown, who wrote the musical The Bridges of Madison County, coming to the Wharton Center later on this week. And as you were talking about the octet of musicians, a lot of that is the orchestration that you made, which you also received a Tony Award for. So how does that process begin for you? First writing on a guitar / piano, balancing timbres and voices, and a million other things that go into orchestration. How does that process begin for you?
For me, it all is kind of the same thing. When I'm writing the songs themselves, when I'm the characters have a certain sound, And that sound isn't just about their vocal quality. The sound is really about the whole world that's in their heads, you know, what they sound like. And that stuff is very intuitive for me. I get inside that character's head. And for me, a character can only sing in the way they can. You know, it wouldn't occur to me to have, you know, Francesca to start singing a rock and roll song. It's just that sound isn't in her head at all. And so, likewise, I'm constantly evaluating the characters and hearing the music that they would hear. But once you've got that clear, you know, there's a whole lot of dominoes then begin falling, because there are certain things that they will never hear, and there are certain things that they will always hear. There, you know, Robert Kincaid is always going to hear those guitars. That's just part of his life. That's part of who he is. And Francesca's always going to hear that cello. That's part of, you know, where she belongs. And so then it all just starts kind of rolling together. You know, when I write the songs originally, there are places where I know exactly what the orchestra is going to do. And then there are places where I don't really, but I'll discover it once I get that piece of paper out and I've got to start writing the orchestrations. But I've got a general sense from the beginning of any project I work on what the instrumental world is going to be, what the orchestral texture is. And I tend to think of that the way that I think costume designers think of the costumes. You know, there are certain things that make sense in that world, and there are some things that simply don't. And once I've ruled out all the things that don't, then I have this particular palette to play with.
Mm-hmm. Let me back up to the creation of the world of the song itself, and what makes that set in the mid-60s, 1965, and set in the Midwest, not far away from here in Michigan, where we are over in Iowa. How does time and place factor into the creation of the song?
Well, I think that the community of the Bridges of Madison County is very much a character in the show, in a sense. But so understanding what those people at that time would hear, what is the kind of music that was played on the radio, what is the kind of music that was played in their homes and in their churches, and, you know, what they are essentially farm people. They're not the same as, you know, farm people in Texas who were listening to something that was different, but they're farm people. They are Midwestern country folk. They're not people in St. Louis. They're not even people in Des Moines. You know, these are farm folk. And so there is a certain kind of simplicity to the harmonic language that, again, feels automatic to me, that I'm not going to write sort of my usual Stevie Wonder chords and, you know, all kinds of crazy substitutions and, you know, wacky time chasings and things like that. Their world is pretty straight ahead. There's major chords, there's minor chords. And I think that the black and whiteness of that is very much meant to be a portrait of that community, who those people are. And so for me, it feels very straightforward that they live in that place. You know, they don't swing. It's not a funky kind of place. And Francesca, like I said, her vocabulary is going to be much more European, much more classically derived. And you feel when Robert Kincaid starts affecting her, because her music starts changing to start sounding a little more like his. And his is very free form, very sort of Joni Mitchell, it's all late 60s, early 70s, folk rock kind of stuff, you know, a little bit harmonically off the beaten path, you know, a little bit pushing the boundaries. And so the show really for me is about how those three musics collide and, you know, collaborate with each other. But any given song is going to fall on the timeline of those three musics and how they are interacting with each other.
It all fades away. It all fades away. It all fades away. But you.
Composer Jason Robert Brown, who won two Tony Awards for his musical version of The Bridges of Madison County. The national tour of that musical will be in residency at the Wharton Center in East Lansing Thursday through Sunday. Tickets and more information is available online at whartoncenter.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And for Thursday's opening night performance, Current State's Jamie Paisley will also be on hand to interview a couple cast members from the Bridges of Madison County before the show. It's part of the Wharton Center's Insight Preview Series. More about that is at whartoncenter.com. And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Kathy Hoekstra and Susan Demas couldn't be more different politically, but they're uniting their passion for politics to promote civil discourse. We'll talk with them about the new Two Chicks Speakers Bureau that they've created. Plus, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra just signed Timothy Muffet for another 3-year contract. We'll speak with the maestro and learn more about the recently announced 2016-2017 season. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast anywhere, anytime, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We'll see you Wednesday on Current State here on WKAR.